Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, we hope your computer is locked onto our website at kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. The show highlights some of the unique personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington, special. The COVID crisis has changed so much of our country, and indeed, even here in Jefferson County. Our radio station is a whole new world. With an abundance of caution, most of us cannot use our studio equipment to record our shows. Individual DJs can creep into the studio and do their shows in solitary confinement. But those of us who have real live guests are not able to invite them to the studio to record. Needless to say, that changes things. We do have a technological workaround where we create and record the show without even visiting KPTZ's world headquarters in a sweet little trailer at the parking lot of the Mountain View School. Admittedly, our audio quality is not up to our usual standards, but the show must go on. So please bear with us if sound quality isn't quite what we usually deliver. Consider the content. The purpose of Our Town is to share the stories of some of the fascinating people who make up this community. But the show is only a half hour long, definitely not long enough to do justice to some of our fellow citizens. So it's a synopsis. We try to get our guests to talk about their lives, their dreams, and even how they ended up in the northwestern edge of the continent, able to look across the Strait of Juan de Fuca right at Vancouver Island, Canada. Over time, we'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and baristas, the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We try to find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in beautiful Jefferson County amid the deer, the otter, and even the magnificent soaring eagles. The past few months have brought some remarkable changes to our lives. Now, more than ever, don't you wonder who the people are that you see around here? The colder weather makes masks seem almost normal. It's just like wearing a hat or gloves on the frigid morning. But when you watch TV in the evening, don't you find it oddly exhilarating to see people with bare faces? Sometimes the characters are even at a restaurant or on a train or, God forbid, at a football stadium. And what about a hug or kiss on TV? It's lurid and shocking to see people behaving like that. In our upside-down world, a plot line that involves detectives checking for a pulse qualifies as softcore porn. Oh well, this show, Our Town, is designed to help you get to know some of the people around here. You might have seen our guest today riding his bike around town. Really, don't you wonder who those people are who are riding bikes? Who are they in real life? My guest today is Chris James, a man who has a fascinating story to tell. Chris today has a totally different life story than he did just 5 years ago. He literally opened up a Pandora's box and found some amazing people and amazing experiences. But I'm getting ahead of the story. Let's start at the very beginning. So, Chris, are you a local boy born and bred in Jefferson County?
No, I'm not. I was born in the UK, Coventry. And then later immigrated to the States via 6 years in Montreal.
Okay. And where in the States did you ultimately settle in?
And we took Her Majesty's Service steamship, the Ivernia, from Southampton to Halifax. And then we took a train down to Montreal where we lived for 6 years. And then when we decided to move to the States, my mother and my sister and I drove an old Citroën wagon across the country to Los Angeles, where my father had taken up residence to work. At that point, we spent a year in Los Angeles before moving up the coast to Seattle.
I find that high school is a very formative time for people as they transition sort of into adulthood. Where did you do your high school years?
South Seattle.
High school kids have a way of lumping each other into groups, whether it's true or not. They'll say, you know, he's a jock, she's a nerd. You know, things like that. Where do you think they would have lumped you? Not that you have to be, that's what you felt you were. I'm saying, what did they think? What was the common wisdom about Chris?
That's a good question. Dysfunctional.
Okay.
I'm not really sure how people perceived me in those years. I was troubled in high school. I was one step away from, you know, falling into the morass of failure. So it was tough years for me.
What kept you think, from stepping into that morass?
Well, I left high school before I graduated, and a year later I left for Alaska.
And how old were you at that point?
Between 18 and 19 when I first went to Alaska.
Did you know anyone up there?
I left home before I graduated from high school at 17. I had been framing houses with a close friend in South Seattle, and one afternoon we were coming home in the winter and it was raining sideways and there were 10 lanes of traffic, and I just looked around and decided I needed a change. My buddy and I decided to go to Alaska to work. We were hearing stories of the money being made on the Alaska pipeline, and we were fascinated by commercial fishing. The king crab fishery was an absolute frenzy at the time, and there was a lot of money being made. And so we had lofty ambitions of seeking our fame and fortune in Alaska. So
yeah, young men with big dreams.
Yeah, exactly. Another close friend's brother had just gotten married in Hawaii and had taken a position in Anchorage. He needed his car delivered. Buddy and I agreed to drive that car from Seattle to Anchorage for him. I think it was February when we left.
Oh.
It was a brutal trip.
Yeah, I would think so.
We pitched a couple of cases of beer in the back seat and we headed off. And that was pretty much our start to Alaska.
How long did it take you?
3 days.
Wow, that's amazing.
We pretty much drove night and day. We ended up in the ditch only twice. And some long-haul truckers would pull up because they were hauling pipe to the pipeline to begin the Alaska pipeline at the time. They would pull up and throw a rope on us and pull us out of the ditch or out of the snowbank.
That was nice of them.
It really was. We were pretty naive.
Yeah. Oh, well. And so you arrive in Anchorage The friend's brother gets his car.
Yeah.
And what then?
I was broke, and Anchorage was pretty depressing. My memory is all about seeing liquor stores, a lot of indigenous people on the street suffering from alcoholism and just being destitute. It was midwinter and it was cold and it was, you know, dancing between rain and ice and snow. And it was just really tough. It was actually a pretty awful introduction to Alaska, honestly. And I remember being just deeply moved by all that.
You weren't exactly a trust fund baby. What did you do to work to find money?
But I was broke about the fifth day I arrived in Anchorage. Somehow we scared up enough money to fly down to Cordova. We boarded up an old de Havilland Twin Otter, which was probably the most rickety aircraft you could ever imagine at the time, but very reliable aircraft. But we didn't really know that. There were probably 10 of us jammed into this airplane. I remember taking off from Anchorage and just, I was shocked at how fast it climbed, how it just went into such a steep takeoff. We flew over the Chugach Mountains into Cordova, and we were literally flying between these snow-capped peaks. After my introduction to Anchorage, it was absolutely magnificent flying into Cordova. On our way to Cordova, we dropped into Valdez, and the pilot, he was on a pretty level plane as he was flying towards Cordova, and suddenly he just put it into a dive. I hadn't really flown much in my life, and I remember just being absolutely panicked. I mean, I literally went white and was gripping the armrests. Apparently, it was standard procedure to go into quite a dive to get into Valdez. So a few minutes later, we landed in Valdez, and a few people got off, and a couple of people got on, and we carried on to Cordova. I'll never forget seeing guys get on the airplane with knives on their belts. You know, it was a different era.
Yeah, so what did you do in Cordova?
Well, we arrived in Cordova, and again, we were broke, so we got a job at the local cannery.
Processing crab. Huh. Yeah, that was my first introduction to a real Alaska was the cannery in Cordova.
Wow. Yeah. I can't imagine sort of what that would be like. When you say processing crab, what do you mean? Are there machines or is it hand done? What are you talking about?
Well, the crab boats pull up to the outside of the dock. They unload the crab, the live crab, into a tote. And then the totes are rolled in. There's a butchering line where there's a grinder with brushes on wheels.
right in between those two rotating brushes, there's an anvil that comes up, and you take the crab and break off the head and you brush off the material off the sides, and then you pitch it aside and you do another one. It just, you know, it's really quick, repetitive work. And I wasn't very happy there doing that very long. I mean, at first it was interesting, but after you've done it for a day, you're done. Not much fun after that.
It was a pretty tough way to make a living. Repetitive and just really just hard work. Yeah, it wasn't much fun. But, you know, we were broke and we were willing to do anything. So just went for it and got the most out of it as we could.
And so where did you go next? What happened next? Obviously, you didn't stay there for 20 years.
No, I didn't. While we were there, I kept gravitating onto the dock and really was fascinated with the fishing vessels. So I eventually got a job on a salmon tender for the summer. And that was my initiation into commercial fishing. We'd go out into the middle of Prince William Sound, Alamar and Tetitlik, one of the native villages there. And we would buy fish in different locations around the sound. I'll never forget, my watch was midnight to 4 a.m. coming back into Cordova, and the magnificence of the Chugach Range and the incredible amount of wildlife around you all the time was just unbelievable. It had a major impact on me.
Sounds beautiful.
Oh, it was incredible. Yeah, I'll never forget those days. It was really quite an experience. And then I eventually started salmon fishing, purse seining mostly, and ultimately gravitated to the longline fisheries, where I worked my way up until I ended up careering on a halibut schooner, which was a prestigious place to be.
From my understanding of Alaska, work is sort of seasonal. What you do in the summer is not necessarily what you do in the winter. Did you have alternate career as well?
I did. I had, you know, right after high school, before I left Seattle for Alaska, I had begun framing houses. So I continued my construction education and worked in Valdez a bit, the terminus of the Alaska pipeline, putting in Loran Towers in Prince William Sound, working remotely. And it was all a lot of really tough work. It was pouring concrete by hand for the bases for these Loran Towers. And we would go out to these remote sites, and in any weather, it was incredible, some of the weather we had to endure. Sometimes it was so cold that you'd go to start your skill saw up and it would barely run to begin with. But once it got turning, it would actually come up to speed eventually. So there were all kinds of little challenges like that, you know, chipping ice off the deck before you could really do much work for the day. Lots of adventure just in a simple carpentry exercise, you know.
Okay. Ultimately, you went into construction full time. What was your transition there?
I had started dating a woman who eventually became my wife, and we ended up in Yakutat that fall in September when I gave her a ring. She was back in Juneau. She was a fisheries biologist, and she was pregnant, so it was a big surprise. Being an expectant father, I decided to give fishing up. I had one last opportunity to run a salmon tender, which I did that following spring, but it was short-lived also because I wanted to be with my new young family. Started building houses full time.
I believe you told me that you ultimately had three children. Can you just briefly give their names and what they ended up doing?
Well, my oldest daughter is Emily Margaret. Emily is a professor of English literature at St. Thomas University. My son is Spencer Lewis. My son is an epidemiologist working for a private corporation, a research scientist. My younger daughter is Martha Elizabeth. Martha is a project manager with a biotech company.
Cool. Sounds like they all ended up well.
Very successful and just great kids.
You're listening to KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. The show is called Our Town. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. Our Town profiles some of the fascinating people who live and work on the Olympic Peninsula. Today, my guest is Chris James. Up until now, we've been talking about version one of Chris James, somewhat unhappy teenager, dropped out, ended up in Alaska, fishing, construction, lots of adventures. But he settled down, became a contractor full-time. In fact, he ended up having a successful contracting business in Port Angeles for more than 30 years. So, Chris, tell us briefly, how did you end up in Port Angeles from Alaska?
My wife, Mary, at the time, her family had some roots in Port Angeles. Her grandparents had lived there for quite a number of years, and her family still had a cabin out on the Place Road near the mouth of the Elwha River. So she wanted to be closer to her family, and we decided to move down to Port Angeles. I was already becoming, I had quite a successful gig going already. And this was a long time ago too. It must've been 35 years ago. I was making probably $35 an hour at the time. And I arrived in Port Angeles and went to work for a cabinet maker in Squim, and they were paying me $9 an hour. So it was quite a shock and quite a change to go from such a lucrative position up north to coming down here and having to essentially start all over again. But I told the owner of the cabinet shop that I was only going to be able to work for 4 or 5 months, and he was fine with that. Pretty soon, I just started getting my own jobs coming in, and one job led to another one, and I managed to stay afloat. So.
Oh, that's always good. Very good. At some point when you were a youngster, your parents told you that you were adopted. And from what you told me the other day, you didn't, when you were 9 or 10 years old, think much about it one way or the other. But at some point in life, you decided you might check it out. What, tell us that story.
Well, yeah, I was adopted in the UK. I didn't find out I was adopted until I think I must have been 9 or 10 or so. And I didn't have a lot of interest. I guess I didn't even think beyond my immediate family. So it wasn't until I had my own children that I began to think about trying to find my birth mother. And I made several attempts. I had some help. My wife tried to help. I had a dear friend that gave me a bit of advice and offered some guidance and wisdom. And all of it came up short on all of it. I couldn't make any inroads into the Irish or the English adoption system at that point. But things change as our digital age came into play. And when my oldest daughter became pregnant, I decided, it was 5 years ago now, I decided to give it another try. So I reached out to a firm in the UK by the name of Finder Monkey, which is quite kind of amusing. It was at least 2.5 weeks, maybe 3 weeks before I got a reply from them. I'd almost forgotten about it because I assumed that, I'd just been taken for my $500, whatever it was. But the fellow emailed me and he said that we have found a woman who we think might be your mother's sister living in Northampton in the UK. Northampton had never been on my radar, but it's very close to Coventry where I was born. I had a glimmer of hope there. I received the phone number and address of this woman. Her name was Ellen Hickey. And I reached out to her immediately. I mean, within hours, I got on the phone and called her, and she hung up on me. She must have thought I was annoying, apparently. So I waited a few minutes, collected my thoughts, and I tried my spiel again, explaining who I was. And she said, "Oh, go on with you," and hung up again. At which point, I was actually quite proud of her reaction. It was like, you know, who would buy into this story? So I sat down that night and I wrote a letter and I include documents and photographs and my original adoption papers. And I put it all in an envelope and mailed it off in the morning, and not knowing what would become of it, obviously. But
about 2 weeks go by and I open up my email one morning. There's an email from a woman named Lita Hickey, who is the daughter-in-law of Ellen Hickey. And in her email, she stated that everything that I had suggested in my correspondence with her mother-in-law, Ellen, was correct, that Ellen was the sister of my mother, Teresa, and that she knew of the birth of David, who was my name at birth, and that it had been a secret between two of the sisters and my mother.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite a shock. So in the emails, she revealed this incredible family that I've come to know.
So at that point, your biologic mother was dead, right?
Yeah. In the first couple of emails, Lita told me that she had passed away, but she also introduced me to the family. My mother was one of 12 children, so there were a lot of cousins suddenly.
Large yeah. Irish Catholic family, I presume. Yeah.
And it also turned out that my mother had, after she had given me up for adoption, she had gotten married and gone on to have 5 more children. One daughter, her oldest daughter, was born in Wales 2 years later. And then her and her new husband and her new daughter had moved back to Ireland from Wales over to Wexford and Enniscorthy.
Well, so all of a sudden you had 5 siblings. How did they receive you? What did they think?
After they were informed of my existence, apparently it was an incredible shock. I've heard stories about how they all reacted, and it was absolutely shocking to them. I mean, they had grown up with this lovely family in rural Ireland and had married this narrative of their family. And then suddenly it was all thrown into question. And I know my cousins in Northampton before, they were having trouble like trying to figure out how to introduce this whole new paradigm to them.
But it would be pretty shocking.
I was out at my place in Joyce and I was walking in the forest and I got a call from what turned out to be a cousin in London, David Tunney. And then the next day I received calls from two of my sisters in Wexford and my brother who lives there, Mary and Essie and John. And it just left me in tears. I was just beside myself. I absolutely lost my voice. I could hardly talk to them. But eventually we had some nice conversations over the phone. Once I collected my composure, was able to speak. They were lovely. They were quite welcoming and it was charming. It was very nice.
At some point you decided to go visit them, right?
It was very soon after I discovered the whole family. I made reservations within, I think it was within 2 or 3 weeks. I had a booking to fly over later that summer. I ended up flying to London first and meeting cousin David Tunney, who was a lovely man. And he met me at the airport and accompanied me through the tube to where he lives in south of London. And then we took the train down to Northampton to meet a whole bunch of more other cousins that lived there. And I met my aunt, Ellen Hickey, who was 84 at the time. And she was lovely. And I sat with her for a long time and thanked her for bringing this to me. I was very grateful to her.
Were some of them sort of reserved about opening up to you? I mean, it would have been quite a shock to find out after all these years that they had an older brother.
I think the Irish they're a very welcoming culture, and it's easy to engage in conversation with Irish people. And a couple of my siblings were, I think because of the shock and the change of narrative of their family, I think it was very difficult for them to accept this new paradigm. So a couple of them had more difficulty than the others, and some of them were really easy with it and still are. But all the cousins I've met, who I've become very good friends with, quite a few, or, you know, maybe a dozen of them, and they are incredibly welcoming, and there's no, you know, there's nothing tough about it at all. It's just lovely. We have wonderful conversations, and I reach out pretty regularly to them through WhatsApp, emails, and yeah, it's been very nice.
And what about the other end of the spectrum? You have three children of your own, and now they all of a sudden have cousins and second cousins and aunts and uncles and that they didn't know about. What was their reaction?
Oh, they're completely on board with it. And in fact, my daughter Martha flew over on that end of that first trip and met everyone also in Ireland anyway. She came to Ireland and met all the family in Ireland. Because they're spread out in all over in London, Northampton, the UK, and then all over Ireland too. They're in Dublin, Cork, Wexford, Enniscorthy, Galway, and up in the west in Mayo. I met Martha at the airport, and we drove all across Ireland for 2 weeks, and she met pretty much all of them. It was really fun. We had a great time.
So that was, I guess, it was 4 years ago when you first went over there.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you gone more than once?
I have been over 4 times now because I love this family dearly. I enjoy spending time with them, and I think they really get excited when I call and say I'm coming over again. They're very welcoming, and we have a great time together. Yeah.
Well, obviously, in the day of COVID, you aren't going again really soon. Have any of them managed to come over here so far?
A few of them have intimated that they'd like to come over. And actually, one sister was going to come over. My sister Julia was going to. I think she was pretty set on coming this summer, but obviously that's not going to happen now.
Right. Well, so, you've had a couple of years to let it sink in now. How do you think it's impacted you, your life view?
It definitely changed some fundamental perceptions of myself and my world. I mean, I feel much more grounded now. Like, you know, I have more of a sense of belonging than I think I had before. I mean, I have my own family here, my children that are very important to me, and we have a loving relationship. That's provided me with a sense of grounding, but this was something much deeper even because it's my root. I've been to where my mother was born and my grandparents had a little farm, and I have cousins that still live there. And it's just the most charming, tiny little country, one-lane roads and old stone farmhouses. It's just lovely. And so it's given me a sense of history and connection, and provided those roots, which most people have already. But for me, I guess it was never there. And it feels great. It definitely has changed me in a profound way.
Can you sum it up a little bit? Has it made you, what, more thoughtful, more what? I don't know.
Well, I think it has. I think it's given me a new depth of appreciation for family and connection and those roots. I find myself being a little more introspective and philosophical since all of this has come to pass. I just discovered Joe Biden's roots are very close to my grandparents in Foxford, where I have cousins living. So that's been kind of fun. Our great grandparents could have known each other. You know?
It's possible. It's possible. Well, Chris, believe it or not, we're just about out of time. Okay. I want to thank you so much for being a guest on the show. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. My guest today has been Chris James, a sailor, a builder, a family man, who finally found his biological family in Ireland and now has a whole clan of Irish brothers, sisters, cousins, second cousins, whatever. He's got it. In addition to thanking Chris for being on the show, I want to thank my partner, John McPherson, the editor and producer of Our Town. Normally, he sits in a glass booth with microphones, computers, and lots of other equipment. But that's not what's happening today. He's not even inside our locked studio. He's hidden very far away. But he will still manage to distill what we're saying so that we sound ever so intelligent and much more eloquent than we really are. He will iron out our stumbles and mumbles. Like all of us at KPTZ, John's a volunteer. He gets zero pay for all his work creating the show, but now he gets combat pay for editing in the time of Corona. That's $0 plus 0 cents. Seriously, in an abundance of caution, we're still not able to use our usual equipment and the studio. Quality might not be up to our usual standards, but remember, it's content that matters. We're all trying to make it through the crisis together. I want to thank you, the listener. KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend, is a community radio station. Everyone who works here is a volunteer. We give our time because we believe that Jefferson County needs a free local voice. We need you, dear listeners. We need volunteers. We also need donations to stay afloat. Like all businesses, we have rent to pay, electricity to pay, and many other expenses. We're currently remodeling a building at Fort Worden, which will be our new headquarters. Just like you, all of us at KPTZ would really like to return to some version of normal. So listener, stay safe, stay healthy. I'm signing off for today, but please keep listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by John McPherson.